Welcome to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and for this week's show, we have the one and only Lembit Opit. As always, you can catch up with all things Brexit Podcast at brexitpodcast.com, at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But now I'm going to leave you to the wonderful Lembit and his views on all things Brexit. It's a warm welcome to our next guest, who is the Director of Communications and Public Affairs at the Motorcycle Action Group. Not heard from him for a while, so it'll be interesting to find out what he's up to as well. Welcome to the show, Mr. Lembit Opit.
Thanks very much indeed. Great to be here.
It's great to have you on. Now, the Motorcycle Action Group, my attention was piqued on them when I was doing a little bit of research into the what caused the EU referendum. And a memo that I read from Steve Baker, who was kind of influential in forcing the government to take that EU referendum, said, on 25th September 2011, I believe, 40,000 motorcyclists took part in the Motorcycle Action Group's nationwide protest, EU Hands Off Biking. The only question that matters today is whether our position in the EU is a proper subject for a referendum, one way or another. All three parties have previously said that it is. So the Motorcycle Action Group had some issues with the European Union. They got the referendum. We're going to leave. Everyone happy now?
No, not everybody is happy because ultimately there are two things here, whether we should be in the European Union or not. And in fairness, the Motorcycle Action Group doesn't have a position on that. We can't have because, like the country, it's probably pretty split between staying in and leaving. And there are so many other issues related to that question which don't specifically refer to motorcycling, that MAG can't take a position on that. We just split our organisation. But the second point is very relevant. The motorcycling community is really a libertarian organisation. You don't have to ride on two wheels. It's a lifestyle choice. And there are lots of people who want to tell us how to live our lives. And that's what was behind the demonstration 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. And while you've rightly read out the wording, really, the specific point for the Motorcycle Action Group was that we don't like to be told how to live our lives from Westminster or from Europe. And at that time, there were some very serious threats coming into how you ride motorcycles in this country and across the EU. And that's what really provoked the organisation into having that demonstration.
So tell us a little bit about your interest in motorcycles in the first place.
I first rode on the back of a motorcycle in 1980. He was called Mike Newman, the rider, going out with my sister at the time. And it was a Kawasaki 100cc little single engine thing. It wasn't particularly fast, but I was blown away by it. And now, 37 years later, it's my job. I got my first motorcycle in 1982. It was called a Yamaha YB100. I rebuilt it myself. It took me so long that my friends called it the Why Bother. But I did do it, and I've understood mechanics ever since. And I've pretty continuously owned motorcycles right up till today, and I still ride.
And in terms of sort of the European bureaucrats wanting to meddle in the world, what were some of the specifics that they maybe wanted to stop you doing, and is the situation going to be different now?
I work for MAG because I myself am an intense libertarian. I think that you should have the right to make decisions, lifestyle choices, even bad ones, as long as they don't harm other people. The problem with the European legislation was it was interfering with our right to decide how to live our lives. The classic example of this is the helmet law, the mandatory rule which says you have to wear a helmet if you ride a motorbike in this country. There may be many good reasons for doing so, but you don't harm anybody else if you have an accident without a helmet. So MAG was founded on a libertarian principle. And what we were seeing coming from the European Union were various restrictions which really harmed our freedom without helping any third party. For example, there was a debate about whether there should be a limit on the horsepower of a motorbike. They wanted to limit it to 100 bhp, not for cars, but for motorbikes. Then there were various threats about increasing what an MOT is, something called a super MOT was going to be introduced, which didn't seem to have any safety benefit in the UK at all. The third example would be having to wear certain protective gear, not through choice, but through law. Now, once again, that's a third example of something which might make sense, but it should be a personal choice. So by 2011, riders were getting so fed up with this kind of thing that tens of thousands of us demonstrated in the UK and said, hands off biking. And that's what Steve Baker was picking up on.
Okay. What would you say to someone who would say, yeah, if you don't wear a helmet and if you wear dark clothing, that could be your personal choice, but then actually if somebody hits you and that's your fault, or that person that hits you's got to live with that, so that's going to be playing on their consciences.
Okay, let's apply that to drinking. Let's ban alcohol. Alcohol is responsible for a lot of problems in this country. Let's ban smoking, make it illegal. Let's ban fatty foods. Let's ban obesity, which also has the same kind of impact. The problem is it's inconsistent to do it for motorcyclists, but then allow all these other bad behaviours, if you want to describe them in that judgmental way, to continue. So bikers take a different route. We will tolerate other people's quirky and sometimes irresponsible lifestyle choices as long as they don't directly impact upon us. That's the essence of freedom, not to be allowed to do things that everyone agrees with, but to be allowed to do things which other people may find objectionable, offensive even, and unwise. And it's not comfortable. We don't live in a society which easily understands that that is the essence of a free society. But in a sense, the motorcycling community is a visible reference to that choice. Nobody has to ride a bike. Nobody has to drive in a car. But it's a choice that we make. And we were worried that the Eurocrats were making the same kind of mistakes that we've had from the bureaucrats in Westminster. Mm. They're not worse than Westminster, but they were making the same mistakes.
If we don't have the legislation then coming through from Europe, are we not going to have the bureaucrats in Westminster putting you in the same boat? It seems in every walk of life there seems to be a drive to sort of be more protective, be more health and safety conscious. It's tripping us up in many ways, you know, pardon the pun, I guess we could argue. But are you not going to be replacing, you know, one problem with another?
It's absolutely true to say that in any advanced political system, at the moment, the trend seems to be towards an authoritarian approach, which is simply to say that the state likes to tell the citizens what to do for our own good. And if it's not coming from Brussels, it could come from Westminster or from Edinburgh, from Cardiff, from Belfast. But note again, Motorcycle Action Group policy is not to withdraw from the European Union. It's to withdraw from authoritarian policies wherever they come from. So we weren't actually demonstrating against the EU. We were demonstrating against legislation that happened to come from the EU. It's a subtle but very significant difference.
Yeah, understood. Just changing tack slightly, I was listening to Nick Clegg the other day, said that liberalism's on the decline. It's from Nick, and also that the Liberals are now really the insurgency. Now, you're a Lib Dem member. How do you see the position? The Liberals got a role to play? A lot of people perhaps wouldn't even know Tim Farron was.
Nick Clegg is right to say that liberalism is on the decline. And he's partly responsible for that. It's partly his fault, because I have had an ideological problem with Nick Clegg's position for years. He doesn't seem to understand the core element of liberalism, which is that uncomfortable tolerance of other people's behaviour that we may not agree with. And unless you understand that, you don't really understand what freedom's about. I've suggested to Nick very recently that we bury the hatchet, that we stop having our decade-long spat. And it's been very publicised. I wrote a book about him calling for him to resign. He didn't. I warned that if he didn't resign from the leadership of the Lib Dems, the party would collapse. It did. Then he did resign anyway. So I've been vindicated in my warnings. But
it's quite a spat if you go and write a book about it.
Because I was trying to save the liberal movement in this country. Sadly, I wasn't able to prevent Nick Clegg from leading the party to a disastrous 2015 general election, and my predictions came to pass. I'm not pleased about that. Lots of my friends lost their jobs, and the country lost that libertarian or that liberal movement. But he had eroded it a great deal anyway, with all kinds of contradictions which aren't directly related to motorcycling. But, for example, he was happy to prevent people from exercising free speech in university campuses because they were taking extreme, non-violent extreme views. Well, that's completely contrary, not just to the principles of liberalism, but also to Lib Dem policies which have been passed. So that's a problem. But is there a space for it? Well, if there isn't a space for libertarian and liberal principles, there isn't space for a free democracy, and we might as well pack up and have some sort of an autocratic or even a dictatorial system to take over.
Mm. You optimistic or pessimistic then about our future then, Bit?
I'm optimistic because these things are cyclical. And the reason I'm optimistic also is because technology tends to be pushing the boundaries of what people can know and what people can say. The internet has all kinds of flaws, but it also makes it a great deal more difficult for authorities to silence opinion. The Brexit vote is a classic example of empowerment, whether you supported it or not. The fact is, the public rose up and said, we don't often have a say. We've been bullied by the Remain campaign with ludicrous claims, such as if the United Kingdom leaves the European Union, there'll be a World War III. And it proved that the public can have a voice. Donald Trump's election is the same. I think Jeremy Corbyn's election to leader of the Labour Party and his re-election with an increased majority is once again two fingers at people who are the authoritarian establishment. So I am optimistic, but at the moment, liberalism is at a low ebb. You mentioned the current leader, that's Tim Farron, who I've known for 25 years. There was a period when I even mentored him in Newcastle upon Tyne, when he was a student politician there. He's got a big mountain to climb because he's got the same number of MPs, or more or less the same, as the DUP in Northern Ireland. Mm. And meanwhile, the SNP are the active third organisation with over 50 MPs. So the reason he doesn't get that much coverage is because he just doesn't have much sway in Parliament. That's not his fault. That's more Nick Clegg's fault. Mm. But the party's been there before. And if I'm right, that liberalism is still something which at least millions of people still value in this country, it will come back. But it's going to take a time.
Do you think we should have had an EU referendum?
I think we had to have an EU referendum, yes. The reason's simple, because it was an increasingly motivating issue to the public. Two bits of evidence. The opinion polls showed that the public were very divided on the question, and that was borne out in the ultimate vote. And secondly, the litmus test for this was the relative success of UKIP, the UK Independence Party. They wouldn't have been doing so well if the public didn't want to express an opinion about all of this. In my view, the whole Remain campaign was almost laughably badly mishandled. And there was an enormous complacency in the establishment about it. Mm. But the outcome, whether you like it or not, was less important than the right to give the public a voice. Mm. And I think that our campaign in 2011 to say we need to talk about the context here is something which tended to lend support to the fact that we needed to have an honest debate once and for all about it.
Now, you're brought up in Ireland from Estonian parents, is that that's correct, right?
Yes, I was brought up in Northern Ireland, that's
yeah.
right.
And just Jeremy Corbyn recently sort of made a speech in Peterborough, which was quite a sort of move towards the anti-immigration line in some ways, and it feels like perhaps we're an anti-immigration country now. What's your view on that? I mean, it must be a...
We're very contradictory about it. It's really not about foreigners, it's about familiarity. My name is quite well known, and I still remember famously when a woman came to the door in Newcastle upon Tyne when I was standing for the local authority there, and she said, who's the Labour candidate, Lembit? And I went, it's a woman called Hilary Franks. This actually happened, Hilary Franks. And she went, Hilary Franks? That's a strange name, Lembit. Is she foreign? And I had a feeling I was going to win that time, and I did. So it's not what we think about where people come from. It's whether we're used to it. Boris is not a very British name, but Boris Johnson is regarded as a very British politician. Are we a racist country? Yes, but every country or most countries I've been to are. Maybe Sweden isn't, but by and large, those are the underlying feelings. Does it make us terrible people? No, we've all got prejudices. And we've got a choice, really. Either we pretend that we can't talk about it, in which case people in pubs will still talk about it, but they won't do it in front of their betters, or we do talk about it and say, OK, well, what's the barrier here? What is it that we don't like about the Poles or the Nigerians or the Russians? And then maybe it's a bit more of an honest conversation based on human nature rather than on style and political correctness, which doesn't really help us much.
What if the reply to that is there's just too many people coming in?
That's a perfectly valid debate again, but it's not dependent on where people come from. you can argue that the country is overpopulated. Then we have to look at the measures. Is the economy suffering because of it? Is there a housing shortage or an NHS crisis because of it? Those are entirely legitimate discussions. And I wouldn't brand someone a racist for having those discussions. If 400 million people moved onto the Isle of Wight, that would be an overpopulation problem, regardless of where they came from. So we need to distinguish prejudice from an informed discussion. It seems to me, incidentally, that probably our economy is growing because our population is growing. I can't be sure about it, but the circumstantial evidence would suggest that to me. It's really bad if we can't have a conversation where the counter-argument can also be expressed.
Mm. So if you were having that conversation, have you got a solution then for you know, the immigration problem, if we call it? What would be your solution now as we move forward and move out of the European Union?
You're sneaky there because you said the immigration problem, which makes an assumption that there is one. I'm not convinced that, on balance, the country would be better off if we
There's a problem in so much as we're divided as a country over the issue.
That's true about taxation policy. It's true about grammar schools. It's true about foreign policy, Afghanistan, how to deal with the terrorist threat. We're divided on lots of things. But OK, let's look at this one. This is the challenge that you've set here. In my opinion, probably we do need to have young blood coming into the country and a form of immigration to backfill jobs that the indigenous and ageing British population can't do or won't do. We will have about 7 million people of pensionable age within 10 years. Someone's got to look after them. And probably we will see a lot of those jobs being filled by people who come into this country. Second point, if there is a clear statement of intent by this country that they want immigration to be handled differently, and I think that's probably what the Brexit vote does say, then we have to respect that. Never mind what I think. A lot of people are talking about a points-based system for immigration. That's not a dumb idea, and you shouldn't shout people down who suggest it. Australia's got it, and it does seem to be potentially viable. But the irony is, we might have just as many people coming in because the points-based system will simply let viable, hard-working people into the country to fill jobs that we've got. So we had 300,000 people coming into this country last year. We might have 300,000 next year, even under a points-based system.
Mm. And then it sort of rules out any kind of compassion, I suppose.
I think this country understands the difference between a refugee crisis and economic migration. We've been a very tolerant country in terms of the refugee crises down the years. That's why I'm here, because my parents were refugees in a crisis, escaping the jackboot of Soviet Union policy, which would probably have liquidated my family if they'd been sent back into the USSR. On the other hand, perhaps we're less tolerant of people who are trying to better themselves on an economic basis. I don't really think it's wrong for people to move. I live in London, not particularly because I want to, but because my work keeps me here. Mm. It would be much harder to do this interview if I was 210 miles away in Wales. Mm. And therefore, I don't think there's a place for harshness. I think there is a place for objectivity. And the word compassion can be used in an emotive way. Politics, which is based on emotional statement, however appealing it might be, isn't very good politics. So if we are going to let people in from, let's say, Syria and Libya, then let's do it on the basis, not that it makes us feel a bit better, but because we actually have a moral responsibility to help clear up the mess that we were partly responsible for creating with our ludicrously irresponsible foreign policy in the Middle East.
Mm. Over in this country, disparity between the rich and the poor is one of the greatest of perhaps any country, a developed country. Have you got a solution to that? Is there something that we could do? Is that, should there be a salary cap? Should there be more pressure put on the financial institutions so that bonuses are kept down? Should there be more housing supply to help take people off the streets? Homelessness is growing exponentially at the moment.
Your question contains different social issues there. Let's go through them. Can you limit the difference between the richest and the poorest? There'll always be extremes in every system. you can reduce the number of people at the extreme. For example, if you had a tax on land so that people can't hoard land, and that in that situation the have-nots, the less wealthy people, become renters from the wealthy landowners. Now, that's been a problem for centuries. That's actually one of the key motivators for the liberal movement. You could do that, but there's so many vested interests, we probably won't. Therefore, taxation is a viable option. Once again, the winners write the history, and the people in Parliament tend to be better off, so they don't really like it, and they don't like to annoy their paymasters. So once again, you can argue about the solutions, but you'd probably lose an election if you did it. You've mentioned housing. It's a slightly different issue. What could we do about that? We could have an aggressive house building programme. It's been done in this country before, in the 50s, for example, but there isn't the will to do it. And that's an irony, because if you actually did have a massive state-sponsored house building scheme, you could kickstart the economy dramatically. It's proven that you can do that. But they don't want to borrow more money than they already have. So if you look at the whole thing, we can talk about the solutions, but there isn't the political will to do it, because each solution has a negative which would cost dearly at the ballot box in the short term.
Hmm. Interesting stuff. Thank you. You're a London resident now. You previously bid to be the Liberal candidate for London Mayor. If you got that role and you knocked Sadiq out, not literally... What
I have done wrestling, but I wasn't very successful.
Yes, many things, Lemhib. What would you implement? What would you bring into change?
Transport.
For the last couple of days, yeah.
Last couple of decades.
True.
The problem with our transport system is not handling the underlying issue. Too many people are trying to do journeys in this city, actually in the country too. And there's not enough space. So I'd rather than trying to fit everybody onto our crammed roads and public transport, I'd encourage home working. A lot of jobs could be done from home. So maybe you go to the office for maybe 3 days a week. There's still a big value to that socialisation. But 2 days a week, you could operate from anywhere. You could operate from an island in the Bahamas, really. And we're not being very forward-looking in that sense. My parents come from Estonia. I do quite a lot of work there. They're incredibly internet savvy. You don't know whether somebody's sitting in an office, in their house, on their boat fishing, or frankly in an airport. So I would reduce the burden. The second thing I'd do is have a reality check about what I think is the insane expansion of the cycle lane schemes. It's just not feasible to pretend that this is an economically worthwhile thing to do. There were 9 cyclist deaths in 2015 in London, and they've got a budget of roughly £1 billion to make them safer. There were 36 motorcyclist deaths in the same year, and the budget is almost zero. Somebody told me it was £2 million. Well, let's round that down to zero.
Okay.
And therefore, I would say London's not a very suitable place to go cycling, in a sense, but we're not going to make it better by making it really hard for the other 97.5% of traffic to use the roads. You only have to go along the north side of the Thames now, around Westminster and on the embankment, to see total gridlock and virtually empty cycle lanes. So however popular or unpopular it is, I don't know, but I would say let's get a reality check on that one. There are also some health issues which aren't widely publicised about cycling, which I won't go into now. But
just give us a flavour of that.
There was a piece of research which is in the public domain, but not very well publicised, which looked into the effects of cycling on your health. Cycling for Health, in fact, sponsored it. So
right.
They presumably thought this would be a very positive, glowing...
endorsement of getting on two wheels.
Yes,
getting
onto two wheels and cycling your way to work or whatever. It turned out that if you're 50-plus... male and you cycled 8.5 hours a week or more, compared to somebody who cycled about 1 hour a week, your risk of prostate cancer goes up by around 513%. Now, we were so shocked by that figure that we spoke to the man who did the research, and he said, no, it's true. We said, why? He said, I wasn't sponsored to find out why it was happening. but the causal link is definitely there. Well, it's an uncomfortable piece of reading, and if anybody listening can explain to me that I've misunderstood that research, I'm very happy to issue an unequivocal retraction, but I've been through that research. So as Mayor of London, I would say just be aware this is one of the consequences, potentially, if you're cycling. And then I'd also say cycle if you want, but recognise there are dangers associated with that. And the actuarial risk is fairly high, okay. But the utilitarian cost of making it okay for cyclists is harming hundreds of thousands of other road users every day. So that would be a big one, maybe controversial, but there it is. Two other things. I would make it much easier for people in London to work close to home. Now, I've mentioned home working, but just to make sure that the communities aren't all centre-centric, mm-hmm. if you like. It's nice to come into the middle, I suppose, but you shouldn't have to travel, do that commute. People don't smile a lot on the underground in the mornings. So I would have an ambitious scheme working with local authorities to do that. And then the third one is I get on with building the dam runway for Heathrow Airport. And I would open Manston Airport, which is currently shut, which has a perfectly good runway, the sixth longest in the UK, and make that the interim airport for London. It would cost peanuts compared to all these other schemes.
And for anyone who's not from the area, where is that exactly?
Manston is about 50 miles southeast of here. So if you were heading towards Dover, you go somewhere near Manston. It's quite near a high-speed rail link. It would need a few miles of extra rail link to go into the airport. It's actually lined up with Germany because the bombers returning from World War II used to use it as an emergency landing zone. The runway is 2.7 kilometres long. It's big enough for a jumbo, for an A380. And it's currently lying dormant. There's a big debate about whether it should be opened or used as a housing estate. I would open that airport because in the real world, aviation is expanding by 5% per annum, making a negligible, in my view, contribution to environmental harm. And an enormous contribution to redistribution of wealth and keeping Britain connected.
Yes. Now, aviation is a subject quite close to your heart. Paragliding accident back in 1998 that nearly put paid to you.
Fatal accident.
Yeah. Right. Is it legislation coming in that area as well that you would, you know, in the same way as the motorcycles, that you would say, actually, you know, hands off. If I want to go and break my neck paragliding, let me go and do it. Is that another area of concern for you?
I was the president of British Hang Gliding and Paragliding Association for a while, and it was precisely for the same reason I worked for the Motorcycle Action Group. It was my choice. You might have said, because of my incompetence, if it was my fault, it was my dumb choice.
Was it your fault, incident?
I don't know if it was my fault or not.
Right.
I increasingly think that I did make a mistake with something called the air brakes. I'm not sure, but I'm certainly willing to entertain that possibility. If I'd been a hugely experienced pilot, I had been doing it for 5 years, but if I'd been doing it for 15, would I have had the same accident? Probably not. So I'm assuming the wind conditions were very difficult that day. So it might have been beyond my competence to fly in those conditions. One way or another, I crashed. I take responsibility for it because I didn't have to take off in the first place that day. I fell about 30 metres,
right,
and
okay.
I didn't reach terminal velocity because I'm still here, but I did break my back in 12 places. It costs the NHS money, it still does, but I'm willing to pay for other people's health costs if they do dumb things. I'm grateful that the NHS has paid for mine up to a point. It has cost me something as well, but
it's
a good example of a libertarian principle. As long as you tell people the risks, whether it's cave diving, swimming, cycling,
eating witchetty grub when I'm a celebrity,
that's not dangerous. I actually quite like wasabi, so some of those things are quite delicacies for aborigines. But eating witchetty grubs, a witchetty grub burger, it's my choice. I think the witchetty grub may have something to say about it, but I'm not vegetarian.
You've had a fascinating life. Leicester City fan as well, so 2016 wasn't all bad.
Who would have thought it?
Wow, incredible.
I first supported Leicester City when I was about 10 for no better reason than my grandmother lived there, spent summer in Leicester. It's an entirely notional, random thing who you support, let's be honest about it, but I chose Leicester City. And My ship came in last year. I think once in every lifetime, Leicester City should win the league. It's the first time they've ever done that. And it was 5,000 to 1, actually, the odds. It was great. I shed tears of joy the day that happened. I see it in the round. My life isn't defined by football, but it's a bit of fun. Interestingly enough, if you'd bet on Leicester City winning the league, the Conservatives winning the 2015 general election, Donald Trump becoming President of the United States of America, Jeremy Corbyn becoming the leader of the Labour Party. And there's a fifth one I can't remember now.
Leaving the EU, perhaps.
Brexit.
Yes.
The Brexit vote, you're right. At the right time, if you'd put £1
£1, yes.
On an accumulated bet on those five facts, you'd have ended up with £15
billion. Wow, wow, incredible. What does 2017 hold for you then, finally?
Well, a bet on Elvis, I suppose, coming back. 2016 wasn't bad for me. 2017 is the year where I want to work a bit less because I've said yes to so many things and I'd rather give lucrative opportunities to other people rather than just hoard it myself because it's too much. I don't have a work-life balance correct at the moment. And if I can get that right, everything else will follow. I would like to make some slightly smarter libertarian decisions about my lifestyle. I think I don't sleep enough. I probably go out too much. And if I can do that, maybe it's the year I can have a slightly more mature attitude towards life. And I think the third thing...
No more stand-up?
That's not bad for my health. It just might be disappointing for the audience. It works okay sometimes. I had quite a good set.
Did you have any good heckles?
Yes, well, the best one was when I was performing on the left field stage at Glastonbury. I've done Glastonbury.
Wow, okay.
And thanks to my friend Billy Bragg, who gave me a chance way too soon in my comedy career, such as it is.
Some people would probably cruelly argue that you've had a comedy career for a long time.
Who's laughing now? Right. And somebody who was in the audience during my comedy hour shouted, there's a phrase that's been used before, but shouted, "When's the comedy hour start, Lembit?" And that was quite crushing. I think that's probably the day that taught me humility. I've had a few good gigs. I did one in Sunderland this year, in fact, in a hotel, and it went really well. But I don't depend on it for my income, and it's just as well, because it's a loss leader for me. But it's the hardest performance set there is, and it's improved my political performance, such as I do. And I do a lot of broadcasting, and it helps me with that too. So what's 2016 hold for me? An opportunity list which exceeds the time to do it. I need to prioritise. And I think I also need to remember that the meaning of life is the journey itself. But you have to do it in such a way that you remember to look out the window rather than just looking at the dials.
And just very finally, a smooth rollout of Brexit, do you see?
Very finally. That means there'll be another one. A very, very finally question too. There won't be a smooth Brexit process because some people are making a career out of making spanners and then putting them into the works. What we're going to get is this clunky public spat between the Ramoners and the Brexiters. I voted to remain, but I'm also a Democrat. I really think we have to accept the outcome. Where will we end up? 2 or 3 years' time, our passports will be a different colour. We'll still not be in something called Schengen, which is a certain free movement thing. We'll still have roughly the same amount of migration from the European Union. We'll still have the pound. And frankly, a little bit like a series called The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, he goes away, he comes back to pretends to be somebody else, but lives with the same wife, in the same house, with the same kids, in the same job.
So everything changes and nothing changes. Lembit Opic, thank you ever so much for being a guest on today's Brexit podcast. And good luck for the future.
Thanks, it's my pleasure. See you soon.